Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. And in today's episode, we have Dr. Joan Rosenberg talking about her book, 90 Seconds to a Life You Love. We're gonna be talking about unpleasant feelings, mastering them, working through them to create more resilience and confidence in our life. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, mindset, and functional medicine with the goal of helping you understand how your brain is not broken. I'm your host, Drew Prode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is Dr. Joan Rosenberg, best-selling author and cutting-edge psychologist who is known as an innovative thinker, acclaimed speaker, and trainer. Dr. Joan Rosenberg speaks on how to build confidence, emotional strength, resilience, achieving emotional, conversational, and relationship mastery, integrating neuroscience and psychotherapy, and the topics of suicide prevention. She's been featured in the documentaries I Am, The Miracle Mindset, Pursuing Happiness, and The Hidden Epidemic. She's also been seen on TEDx, CNN's American Morning, The OWN Network, and PBS, as well as appearances and radio interviews in all of the major metropolitan markets. Dr. Rosenberg is an Air Force veteran. Thank you for your service.
You bet.
And a professor of graduate psychology at Pepperdine University here in Los Angeles, California. Her latest book, 90 Seconds to a Life You Love, How to Master Your Difficult Feelings to Cultivate Lasting Confidence, Resilience, and Authenticity, was released earlier this year. Congratulations on your book,
Dr. Rosenberg,
and thank you for being here on the podcast.
I'm excited and it's a pleasure.
I feel like it's right up the alley of the topics that we discuss on here. So I'm going to jump right into a few things that I want to ask you about.
You bet.
So you have a quote from your book and you say, "What blocks most people from success and feeling capable in life is the inability to experience, move through, and handle 8 unpleasant feelings." Can you tell us what these 8 feelings are and how is our success tied to the ability to move through these feelings?
Absolutely. The 8 feelings are sadness, shame, helplessness, anger, vulnerability, embarrassment, disappointment, and frustration. So the first question that somebody might ask relative to that is, so why those 8? And then you'll see how it ties to success.
Yeah, tell us why those 8.
Why those 8? Because they're the most common, spontaneous, everyday reactions to things not turning out the way that we feel like we need or the way we want. So if you think about going through your daily life and things, and you know, whether it's asking somebody out for a date, it's asking somebody for a promotion, it's saying, I love you, or I want to spend more time with you. It doesn't matter which end of the spectrum we go, or I was disappointed about something you did or didn't do, and then these same 8 feelings or feeling states come up repeatedly.
They're a conflict, an intersection with reality.
With reality.
We wanted something to happen. It didn't.
Didn't.
A feeling mustered.
Right, right. So why it gets in the way of success is because when people don't want to experience these feelings, they won't take risks in their life. So I want to say to people, or I have ideas I want to share, but I'm too afraid of public speaking. So I won't take the risk to put myself out there because I don't want to feel, it's not the action itself, it's because of the feeling outcome.
I want to avoid this feeling. What can I do to stay away from it? Let's not take a risk.
Let's not take a risk.
And I think everybody can relate to that in some way in their life.
And it doesn't matter the domain. It really doesn't. It could be going out and learning tennis. It could be talking to the boss, talking to your kids. It doesn't matter. It's every single domain of our life. So for me, if someone has a tough time experiencing and moving through these 8 feelings, then it really inhibits their life in lots of different ways.
And you work with both graduate students who are working with patients, you also work with patients directly yourself too.
Right.
What other manifestations have you seen that when we design our life around avoiding these feelings, you know, what is the extent of the problem? We talked about avoiding risk. What are some other things that can show up?
There's a kind of a graduated slip down, if you will. at the worst is what I call soulful depression. Mm. And that I think of as a disconnection from ourselves. Lots of times people talk about feeling depressed. And oftentimes I think it's not a genuine clinical depression from psychology standpoint. It's actually soulful depression. It's I'm cut off from myself. I'm so distracted or disconnected from my feelings, which is really the essence of our aliveness, that I feel dead or empty inside or disconnected. So I'm disconnected from me. Now I'm disconnected from you. So that would be the worst outcome. Other outcomes, bodily symptoms, increased sense of anxiety. We can get into the imposter syndrome, because I talk about a whole list of distractions in one of the chapters in the book, we can look at addictions. All the addictions are going to relate to an effort to avoid and distract from what the experience is. So the list becomes somewhat endless in terms of the problems that people have. And what they're doing is now they have the problem, if you will, of avoidance that's layered over by all the other subsequent problems. So now it might be a drug addiction because I'm trying to avoid the experience underneath the drug addiction or the drugs.
And not only have you worked on this with people directly and your own patients and your students, but you've worked through this in your own life and through stories that have come up there. Can you tell us about some of the couple key stories? We'll start off with one.
There's a couple of key ones. There were turning point moments for me. The one that I highlighted in one of the TED Talks is being on a hayride, summer camp counselor.
When you were 19 years old.
Yeah, I was 19 years old. And good time, we're on a hayride back from the boys' camp to the girls' camp. And right towards the end of the ride, one of my co-counselors kind of looked at me, kind of did one of these jabs in the stomach, attempting to be playful of a sort at that moment, but turned to me and said, "Joan, you know what? You're boring." She might have been intending it in a whole different way, but boy, it was like a searing moment for me. And I remember coming off that hayride, being quite tearful, and spending the whole next day somewhat in isolation and crying. In an effort to try to make sense of what that was about. And it's like, I got to figure this out. And I mean, if I look back, I certainly can make sense of what that moment meant and why she said it. And so, but that's one of those moments.
And many people have those moments. They can
right.
be big moments.
Right.
They can be small moments. And in fact, in your TED Talk, you talk about success in life. We often think of as being these big moments where we have to rise to the occasion, but more of your day-to-day happiness is actually related to how you handle these individual moment-to-moment situations.
Absolutely. We think it's the big decisions. And the big decisions like where I'm going to go to school or the mate I choose or all those. They're important decisions. I don't want to downplay the importance. But it's our day-to-day that's way more important. The big decisions are about opportunity. And that's kind of the way I look at that. The small decisions have to do with how we manage our feeling state and how we manage our thinking state. And, whether we hold a negative attitude or a pessimistic attitude, or we hold an optimistic one and pursue life in those ways, or the attitudes we hold makes a difference on a day-to-day, moment-by-moment basis. Or whether we regulated our feelings effectively in a moment. We got really angry at one of our children, but as opposed to lashing out, we were able to hold our tongue, take a deep breath, and then engage in a different way. That's the moment-to-moment stuff that makes a huge difference
in life.
That's
really what your book and your work is about, because you've seen the impact that can have on people's lives when they are able to experience, move through, and handle these feelings. So we'll come back to your story because I have a few more questions about
sure.
it, but I want to jump into this a little bit more. Why is it so important? When I read your book and I was watching your TED Talks and I listened to you on a few other podcasts, I thought of this quote. I don't know if it has an attribution, but it's what you resist will persist.
Mm-hmm.
What you accept, you go beyond.
You move through, right?
You move through. So if part of your work in helping people understand, move through, and experience these feelings is to first not label feelings as good and bad.
Correct.
Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, no, it's if we look at the neuroscience findings over the years and we look at evolutionary psychology, part of the reason our feelings exist, or for especially what we would consider the unpleasant feelings, are for protective purposes.
They're like a smoke detector.
Yeah. It's like, so there are warnings, there's a signal, stay away from that, right? So sometimes we take that too far. And that's probably, again, more related to when we were on the savannah as opposed to in the moment right now. But in this day and time, we do still have to be mindful of those kinds of reactions that we have. So the anger, the disappointment, the sadness, whatever it might be, is a pushback. It's like, no, that feels dangerous. It feels like a threat to me, so stay away. So for me, it's like if we shut down and try to disconnect or distract from the very thing that's designed to protect us, it actually leaves us feeling more vulnerable, more like we could be hurt as opposed to less.
It's almost like experiencing a sensation of pain in your arm,
right,
and covering it up long term with some pain medication or opioids instead of thinking, okay, what is the root cause of this thing?
Exactly.
Can I address it?
Exactly. And so my thing is, it's like, let's understand that at those unpleasant feelings, they're not negative and they're not bad. They're actually there for protective purposes. So let's stop calling them negative or bad, because when we associate the language to that, it actually evokes a state within us.
Right. It's like a parent looking outside and saying, oh, today's bad weather.
Right.
And then now all of a sudden, what happens when you label the day bad? Well, all sorts of feelings and emotions happen. You can't enjoy fun and have joy
right.
on a day that's bad.
Right.
So I want to start at the basics there and just, what is a feeling and what's actually happening in the body when we're experiencing a feeling?
Well, you know, I actually love Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor's description of it. And that's also where the title of the book emanates from. And what she talks about is that when a feeling fires off or gets evoked, we have kind of a natural reaction to something. You know, think of I stub my toe. We have an immediate reaction, kind of a sensation sort of thing. So, but let's do it now on a feeling level. So something, we're reacting to something. What ends up happening is that there's a rush of biochemicals into the bloodstream, and that rush of biochemicals activates bodily sensations. And then there's a flush of those same biochemicals out of the bloodstream in roughly an upper range of about 90 seconds. So that's where the 90 seconds idea comes from.
You call it a wave.
A wave, yes. And I was calling it a wave for years until I started reading the neuroscience where it was calling it a wave. It was great. So it's just the beauty for me is what I was intuiting and doing naturally was all the research was supporting. And now I had a way to explain what it was that I was doing, basically. But so the key here is having people understand that most of us experience feeling, emotional feeling, by bodily sensation. And I had struggled to understand over time. It's like, why is it so difficult for us to experience unpleasant feelings? Because so many of us want to avoid it. I mean, that was true of me early in life. It's like I was trying to move away from probably disappointed and sad feelings. And so I did my own thing. And when the neuroscience started to come out, it was like, oh, two really important things here. Bodily sensation is how most of us experience feeling. So it's not that we don't want to experience the whole range of what we're feeling emotionally. We don't want to experience the bodily sensation that helps us know what we're feeling emotionally. Mm. And if I could then help people tolerate that more effectively, then they would be able to stay present to their experience and then go take the risks they wanted to take to pursue their life.
In fact, when we experience some of those feelings, there's often a response that happens back in our body to sort of suppress it. We feel something in our stomach and all of a sudden we stop breathing.
Exactly.
And we get tight.
Right, right. So there's three main things I see immediately. One is people hold their breath, they tighten up, or they swallow. Mm. So it's an immediate reaction. Why? Think of it. We're pushing something down. Again, we never talk about feelings coming down. We only talk about feelings coming up. So think body up. Body is the body sensation is feeding information to the brain proper. So the key here then is that I want people to understand that if they can ride one or more 90 up to 90 second, and the key is one or more, I'm not just talking about one wave, could be multiple waves, one or more 90 second bodily sensation waves of one or more of eight unpleasant feelings, they can go pursue anything they want in life.
Because that initial wave, if unchecked in, like if we don't check in with it,
right,
that initial wave can lead to another series and a bad moment, a bad,
right,
as people would define it,
right.
I'm putting my quotations up for those of you that are listening,
yes.
Air quotes, bad moment turns into a bad, you know, half hour, hour, day, week, and somebody's stuck in that sort of cycle for an entire year or more.
Right. Well, and what people do is it's understanding. So I want to make a clear distinction based on what you just said. People get the idea that, oh no, come, what are you talking about? Feelings last such a short time. They linger. They've lingered for days, weeks, months, or years. It's like, no. Your memory has lingered. It's your memory. And every time you rethink the same thing, or you rememory, if you will, you bring up the memory again, then you're activating everything that's associated with those memories, including the feelings. So now you're firing off the same approximate feeling that you felt the first time. And it feels like it's lingering because you keep on relooping over and over the same thing.
And sometimes it could start with thought, and sometimes it's just baked into the body, into the default neural network,
right,
into our parasympathetic nervous system and the
yes.
way that we operate, which is all super, super fascinating. So the first part that you talk about being very important in this process is in the importance of labeling our feelings and why we need to understand the distinction between what feelings are. Can you talk about what some of the research says out there about why labeling is so important?
Yeah, think of labeling a feeling as helping you stay centered, more centered and more calm. When we label a feeling, what ends up happening is that now we're engaging our thinking brain into our experience. And when we're able to do that, we're actually able to modulate or manage our emotional state more effectively. And the upshot of that is that we feel calmer, we feel more centered, we feel like we can handle things, as opposed to being reactive, we can be responsive, so that we're not as impulsive. So it actually allows us to calm ourselves down. And here's the interesting thing. I teach graduate psychology, and the key focus of most of that is to teach them how to do psychotherapy. There's a key skill in that, which has to do with the individual's reflecting a feeling back to the other person. So let's say you're saying you're anxious, and I talk a lot about anxiety in the book, but let's say you say you're anxious, and I don't really understand what you mean by that. So I ask you to dig a little bit further into it. And then by the time we're through the discussion, you recognize that you're feeling a little sad or angry, and that's really what's underneath that anxiety. And as soon as I say back to you, you know, well, it actually sounds like you're angry in that situation, often what ends up happening is I'll watch somebody's body just kind of go, oh, yeah, they just kind of calm right down. So one of the effects of the labeling is a calming and centering experience inside the person themselves.
Because somebody feels that they've accurately described or understood what they're going through?
Right. On both counts. One is, if I validate it for you, if you say it, I validate it for you, you now feel more well understood and you can validate it better for yourself. Right? How many times are you in a situation, or you've heard about situations where people grew up and you're not feeling that?
Right.
Right? Or
how could you be feeling this? I'm feeling this. You're angry. Well, I'm upset about this component.
Sorry. So
there's not the acceptance of maybe where you are or what you're coming
right,
from.
Right. So when feelings are labeled, whether it's internally by ourselves or someone's helping us in that process, it helps calm and center us. Super important. And then it gives us the ability to self-regulate even more effectively.
Sometimes I'll notice myself just driving or walking somewhere or thinking about something, and I'm not even actively knowing that I'm thinking through a feeling. I'm just feeling something. I have thoughts, but they're sort of in the background, and I feel a tightness in my chest or I feel something in my stomach. For those individuals that are there, how do they begin to turn that into a labeling of what they're feeling? Is it through a process of asking and answering questions? Is it journaling? How do you unravel the sensation in your body and attach it to a label?
That's a great question. And I would say both are very effective to start asking the questions. Questions prompt our brain to go on the exploration journey, right? So questions are great. And the better you get at asking good questions, really you're going to live a much more effective life and a much more enjoyable life. Probably a topic for another, it's a whole nother topic, but journaling would be equally as effective, partly again because you're engaging your own mind to reflect on what's taking place. But what you can do is, the body's a metaphor. So let's say it's a shoulder pain. Now, maybe you're playing tennis and it's actually, we can just attribute it to playing tennis and you just worked out a little too hard.
Sure.
On the other hand, if you hadn't been playing tennis, then you could ask the question, if we think about shoulder as metaphor, when we talk about shouldering something, then you can engage the body and it's like, all right, what is this body part trying to tell me?
Do I feel the weight?
Do I feel the weight of what I'm carrying emotionally, physically, or otherwise? Right. So you can start to engage those kinds of questions about what your body is literally trying to tell you. A lot of people will talk about the body as our subconscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to use Dan Siegel's term, the non-conscious mind. But yes, you can engage with the body and go, what's the metaphor here? What is it that is hurting? What's that role? What's that function of that body part? And how might it relate to what I'm going through?
And what's great in your book is that you have the description of each of those eight that you had mentioned earlier, the eight unpleasant feelings. And oftentimes I think I'm feeling one, but mm-hmm. actually when I read the description, I'm feeling something else. So mm-hmm. just even knowing the description of the different words, you can know, is this anger? Is this this? Is this
right,
that?
Right.
So in your book, 90 Seconds to a Life You Love, it came out of the desire to answer two questions for yourself. The first one was, what makes it so difficult for people to handle or experience unpleasant feelings? And the second one here that I have in my notes is about confidence and how do unpleasant feelings relate to having confidence? What's the connection between those two questions?
For a long time, I didn't know the answer to that question. But again, over time, what I realized is that when people find it difficult to experience and move through these eight feelings, or they are into much more avoidance, as I said earlier, they won't take the risks to pursue things that they want in life. And what I also found, Drew, is that they don't feel as capable in the world. So if they want to go out and meet somebody new or just engage in whatever way in the world, they won't engage as fully. In essence, because they're afraid of the emotional outcome.
There's things you want to do and you'll hold yourself back.
Exactly. All the time.
I think anybody who's listening now, the question for them is that, in what ways are you holding yourself back? The things that you want to pursue, the things that you want to try, the things that you want to give love and attention to. It's often we think of other people or situations holding us back, but nobody holds us back more than ourselves.
Psychologically. Exactly. But what I want people to really understand is that it's not the thing that they're afraid of. Like putting my work of art out there. That's not what they're afraid of. Or public speaking, or playing tennis. Again, we could name anything. It's the emotional outcome of the thing they're afraid of. So the link to confidence for me, as I began to understand it, is that when we don't experience and move through these eight feelings, we're not going to live life fully. We're not going to pursue the things we want. We're not going to go after the dreams and aspirations we have, all of that. And we won't feel confident because we're not even centered and ground in our own being when we're engaged in that level of avoidance.
If you don't have the ability to cultivate that confidence inside of you or not suppress it in the first place,
right.
Because sometimes people think, how can I get confidence? How can I get it? And the real question is, well, are you suppressing it? Because confidence is there.
Right. Well, I would say yes and no to that question.
Yeah, please.
Yes. So confident, the thing here is to understand that confidence primarily is an inside job.
Yeah.
So it's not going to come from the outside. You know, in my early life, because I was exquisitely shy and I would see all my peers over off to the side, I would go, well, how do I get what they have? If I'm next to them, I mean, will it like, can I get it just by being next to them? That's not the way it works at all. And so it's understanding, and my definition of confidence is it's the capacity, if you will, to handle the, it's the deep sense that you can handle the emotional outcome of whatever you face or whatever you pursue.
Not that you can actually do the thing, because sometimes people think, oh, that person has confidence. They went on stage and they sung a great song. Confidence is whatever way it goes, you can handle it.
Right. And it's the deep sense of that. So the deep sense comes from repeated experience and then ultimately it being embodied in you. So it's not that I have confidence and then I go take a risk, take some kind of action. It's not that I have confidence and then I speak up. It's that as I speak and through speaking, I gain confidence. And it's through the action taking, or through taking action, whichever way you want to say it, that I gain the confidence. That's the only way it happens. And then it gets embodied. And then we have the deep sense. And then we can go after whatever we want.
Because our body, as you said earlier, is just trying to protect us. Our mind and our body is trying to protect us. So it's learning that I took this step. It's okay. I can take now two steps.
Right.
But if you try to develop the confidence before the doing, oh, I need confidence before I go out and start my own business or do the thing or ask the person out. It's like, that's the wrong framework.
Correct.
That's not the, it's not wrong, but it's not going to lead to success.
It's right. It's ineffective. You actually won't gain the confidence, that deep sense knowing that even if stuff doesn't turn out the way you want, that you can handle it.
Tell our listeners why confidence was such an important topic for you. You've talked about starting school early.
Right.
And a few components that might be there, but I would love to hear why was there this focus on confidence in your own personal journey?
Well, again, I started to reference that. I did. I started school towards the end of my fourth year, but I started young and I was always the youngest and smallest in my class. Makes me pretty vulnerable to being picked on, which I also experienced throughout most of my childhood and adolescence.
Anybody who's different or starts off being different.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was a vulnerable kid. I was also exquisitely shy. And I was, at that time, I never wanted to describe myself as sensitive, but I was sensitive. And so I would get affected a lot and I didn't know how to manage it well. I would come home crying. I mean, I was just memories of sitting at the kitchen table with my mother attempting to soothe me after another day of being hurt. So for me, and I would be, because I felt different, it was like, how do I fit in here? And felt so vulnerable, but without that word at that time, I would look over and I'd see all my peers hanging out together. And so they were laughing, they appeared to be confident, and they were belonging. None of which I was experiencing in those moments. So it's like, how do I get what they have? So this question about confidence was an early one for me. And then that started early. And the second one about unpleasant feelings came later as I engaged in my professional life. And then the two became interwoven. So it was, my first question is, how does someone become confident based on those early experiences? And then professionally, it was like, what makes it so difficult for us to tolerate and experience unpleasant feelings? And then over the years, and this has been a 25-year journey, or better, it was to understand that the answer to the second question was actually the answer to the first question.
At what age or at what time in your life in this story,
yes,
was there the recognition of, it's not just me who's going through this. Even other people who seem like they have confidence and seem like they have confidence in one area are dealing with it in another. When did that awareness come in?
Probably at some level in my late 20s. And I started in the counseling field, oddly enough, at the age of 20. So that I started early too. And so I had a lot of time to observe. And so I was engaged in counseling work by the time I was probably 23, 22, 23. And so by my late 20s, I certainly had that level of awareness.
That this wasn't just something that I'm dealing with, that other people have it.
Yeah.
So maybe I went through these things for a reason. How can we now put it to work?
Right, yes.
And in putting that framework together, you developed a formula.
Right.
There's a formula. Can you tell us about the formula and how that plays into this conversation?
Absolutely. So again, what I wanted to do was to make it easy for someone to move towards their experience as opposed to away from it. And because I began, again, it's understanding that our capacity to experience and move through those eight feelings, for me, is the foundation of confidence. So without that, we don't feel as grounded and centered, as I said before. We've got to be able to do that. So the formula kind of emerged, and the formula is one choice, eight feelings, 90 seconds.
One choice, eight feelings, 90 seconds.
Right. One choice, awareness, not avoidance. So I want people to move towards what's unpleasant. I don't want them to back away from it. So the more you can stay consciously aware of what you are experiencing and you are willing to move into it, through it, embrace it, whatever you want to call it, the more you're willing to stay in that awareness, the healthier you're going to become.
If you hear the smoke detector, don't run out of the house. Just start being aware and start smelling.
Right.
Is there a fire? What's going on exactly?
Exactly.
Just have the curiosity of, okay, something is going on. Let me pay attention.
Absolutely. In fact, a great word. The single best thing you can do is to be curious. Yeah.
Versus I feel this feeling of, I remember many, many years ago, I was listening to a tape of Tony Robbins, and he was saying, I used to get these butterflies before going on stage, and my meaning of those butterflies was, I'm not ready. And then I, through his own methodology and his own framework, it's like, I get butterflies. It's like, oh, I'm excited to do this.
Right.
I'm excited. So the reframing and the openness to step out of our default neural network and how our body is relating to things and just change it over to awareness and curiosity.
Absolutely. 100%.
Maybe I don't know what this means. Let's pay attention. So that's the one choice.
So that's the one choice. The awareness is the key. Awareness and curiosity. The second of the eight feelings, which I've named, happy to name them again if you'd like.
Yeah, that'd be great actually.
Okay. Sadness, shame, helplessness, anger, vulnerability, embarrassment, disappointment, and frustration. So those are the eight feelings, everyday spontaneous reactions to life. And then the third is the 90 seconds. And the 90 seconds has to do with your capacity to ride one or more bodily sensation waves of up to that kind of upper range of 90 seconds. Most feelings don't even last that long. So that's the one choice, the eight feelings, 90 seconds. You can do that. You can stay present to the feeling and life changes.
And you can create, riding that wave, you can create a new possibility on the other side of things.
Right.
It's amazing that it's that simple, and yet it's the hardest work that's out there.
Say yes, well, it can be, but I don't want to frame it as hard, actually.
It can be challenging.
It's been challenging, absolutely.
But it's simple.
Yeah, it is simple.
Simple doesn't mean difficult. I mean, you know, hard, like challenging doesn't mean complex.
Right. No, so I've had many people say, well, it's really simple, but it ain't so easy. Right. So it is simple. The concept is simple. And the truth is, and this is what is, it was mind boggling to me, Drew, to realize and to kind of have that click of awareness of, oh my God, it's the bodily sensation that people don't want to experience. But I didn't have that and couldn't have had that understanding until all the neuroscience came out. So it's again, the key here around that 90 seconds is that what you want to do is to stay present to the bodily sensation, because that's the thing that helps you know what you're feeling. And let me take that one step further. Just so that people have what I'm talking about, think of the heat and the redness that comes into a chest or a face when someone's embarrassed. Or think of kind of a drop down sensation at the chest when someone feels sad or disappointed. Or, I've had people talk about a burning sensation in their forearms or at the back of their neck when they're angry. So part of it becomes what someone's ability to notice in their own bodies how, what, and where they experience what they're feeling, bodily sensation, so that they can then interpret and understand, oh, this is the emotional feeling I attach to that. So, but then they can do it. And then, like I said, it's, for me, it's the foundation of confidence.
And do you feel that it's sometimes present to just, that it's helpful to, as you're being aware and present to what you're going through? I know that I talk to myself a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say, okay, where's that? What am I feeling? My stomach is tight. And I'll do it all the time. Even sometimes if I'm out there, if people feel awkward about it, just put in your headphones and people just think that you're talking on the phone. It's like, okay, I feel my stomach feels tight. Okay, what was that? What was I thinking about right beforehand? Or what was I worried about? And I'm just sort of describing out the nature of what it is that I'm going through.
Totally fine. There's also an exercise in the book that I call the how, what, where exercise.
Yeah.
Where literally I kind of walk you through the eight feelings, so that you can start to notice how, what, and where in your own body.
But you do feel it's important that as somebody's working through it, that they label what they're feeling.
I would, yes, if they can get to that point.
Pick one of the ones, the eight.
Start with the eight, yes. Start with the eight, and if they can't, don't worry about it. If you're used to shutting down, then it's gonna take some time for you to wire back up. So if you're very practiced, and I've given many lectures where and the lectures stand out. Oftentimes they're with men who've practiced shutting down feeling. But you've got to think of this. When we shut down bodily sensation, we disconnect from feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And, men get trained to do that.
Right.
Right?
Be strong. Be a man. Don't cry.
Right. Right. Shut down on your experience. So understand, if you can't do it immediately, that there's nothing wrong. Just stay present to it. It will change. And the more you have an interest in noticing how, what, and where you experience it, the more that's going to start to come to you. So sometimes it will take practice, and you might not notice it exactly where it is for yourself right away. When you can, notice it, give it a name, and then see if you can attach, like you do, you're reflecting. Where'd this come from? What was I thinking about before this? What stirred this up for me? Then you can engage in the curious questions to pull it all together for yourself.
A lot of people struggle with fear and anxiety.
Right.
How can someone handle their anxiety better and experience less of it using this methodology?
The interesting thing for me is I really look at anxiety quite differently. And I see anxiety as a cover for the eight unpleasant feelings. And when people start to use the word fear and anxiety, my brain goes on a whole different ride. So part of it is I want people to understand that the use of both fear, the word fear, and anxiety or feeling anxious are misused and overused.
All the time in society, the way that it's like...
Yes. Fear of public...
Talk right. A little bit more about
so
that.
So the fear of public speaking is the most common one. And that's what they say is the most common, what the biggest fear, right, for people. But if you look at the way psychology defines fear, generally speaking, it's danger in the moment right now.
Mm-hmm.
Tiger's right behind you, right? So fear of public speaking, for most of us, there's no danger in the moment right now to be on that stage and speak up. So fear's not accurate. Stop using the word. If you're not in danger right now, stop using the word fear. Why? Because when you use that word, you're activating the experience within yourself. Let's find a better word. Well, anxiety would be the next most logical option. Anxiety, from psychology's point of view, is diffuse apprehension of the future. Well, it fits better, except if I asked 10 people what they meant by feeling anxious, I'd get 10 different answers. So it's too vague, just like the word I'm stressed is too vague. I have no idea what you mean by that. Or I'm freaking out. I have no idea what you mean by that either, right? So where words are vague for me, I tend to dig deeper. So then the next most logical option is, in my mind, is that when most people use the word anxiety, they're feeling vulnerable. And what's interesting is in those situations, if I say that to them, then again, that kind of calming down response, I'll watch that happen. It's like, oh yeah, I'm actually feeling vulnerable. But it changes their state and it changes the way they see things now. So it makes a difference in terms of their own sense of their own ability to handle something. Oh, I was just feeling vulnerable. Okay, got it.
Whereas anxiety feels like this sort of cloud that's like a little bit of opaque, and what does it mean? It's just this general sort of existence that's there.
Right.
And you can't really hold it any particular way. You can't dig deeper.
Unmanageable.
It's unmanageable. And it's, I mean, when people feel anxious, it's often associated with, I feel overwhelmed.
Right.
I'm totally overwhelmed.
Right.
Well, we don't even know where to start. We don't even know how to parse these feelings.
Right.
That we're dealing with.
Right. But, and the other interesting thing for me around anxiety is if it's not vulnerability, it's one or more of the other seven feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I talk about it. It's a, for me, it's a great story in the book. I was working with two graduate students and they both complained of high anxiety, and I just didn't want to disrupt too early. So about 5 or 6 weeks in, I said, you know, I'm not so sure I believe in anxiety in the way that you do. Would you be willing to play? And so they were totally open because they hated feeling anxious. And through the process, so it's a, this is a spoiler alert. Through the process, what I did is I said, if I took all the words for anxiety away from you, what would you really be feeling? So the first one then came up with sadness. The other one came up with anger. I said, great. Now go back to that experience and replace your word anxious with sad, you for sad and the other one anger. So they did. I said, are you still feeling anxious? They went, no. I said, and was anybody else involved in this exchange where you felt anger or sadness? And both of them nodded yes, there were other people involved. I said, did you happen to say something about your anger or something about your sadness to the people that were involved? No. No. And then these huge smiles, it's just like they just lit up. It's like they had a recognition that the reason that they were feeling anxious is because they didn't want to feel sad or angry, respectively, and because they hadn't spoken up.
Mm.
So the other way I look at anxiety, beyond being a cover for the 8 unpleasant feelings, is that anxiety occurs where there's unexperienced and unexpressed feeling.
You're feeling something inside. It doesn't have an outlet or an understanding or an expression.
Right.
Can be with others often.
Or
yourself.
Right.
You don't do anything about it. And so the mustering and the bubbling up of it, which is so, by the way, thank you for that story. I think those stories really make it real for people to parse out and see that when you unravel it and you take each of the strings and you kind of put them aside, you can kind of see what their root issue is.
Right, right, right.
So helpful. Otherwise, we get stuck into, again, this cloud of anxiety, stress, which are really, unfortunately, there's something so much deeper and they're kind of a little meaningless in terms of getting us to the solution.
Right, right. So what I would say to people is that if you tend towards anxiety, notice and be truthful to yourselves. Or to yourself about how comfortable you are experiencing and moving through those 8 feelings and expressing those 8 feelings. You can do your own self-check.
Mm. Beautiful. I love it. I want to talk about a few other things on that. So sometimes, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but sometimes these unpleasant feelings become strong memory, can ultimately lead to, if we have repeated patterns, can be strong memory centers.
Yep.
In the body.
Right.
And one of the big sort of words over the last couple of years has been the word like trigger, you know, people mm-hmm. getting triggered by mm-hmm. different stuff and having through that. What do you think are the steps for releasing painful memories and old stories that are baked into our body? And that if somebody's trying to go through the one choice, eight feelings in 90 seconds, and just feels like they repeatedly are dealing with that, that unpleasant wave, how can they begin to unravel some of those old stories and memories in their body?
I love the question. Your question is centered on what I call disguised grief. And for me, there really is, I don't know if I want to call it a method, an approach, if you will, to dealing with disguised grief. But let me kind of dig into that a little bit first. When I hear someone talking about being resentful or bitter or holding a grudge, or they're cynical or they're pessimistic, for me, those are grief signal words. And immediately what I know is something's gone on in their life that feels painful, that's not resolved, and their use of those words is their signal to me, at least, that there's grief underneath.
They may not know there's grief underneath, but you sort of see the smoke and you know there's fire somewhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So again, people learn their words, then they can go, oh, wait a minute. All right. Unresolved grief. I gotta dig into this. And so there, I think I named like 14 or 15, what I call grief signal words in the book. Those are four or five of them right off the bat. And that takes me to the second part of what I call disguised grief. And that, again, mostly is tied to difficult memory, difficult life experiences. And the second part of it is that I think what people are grieving over is that they're grieving over what they got and didn't deserve. So that's the bad stuff. Think chaos, abuse, drug-addicted parents, whatever it might be. None of it's good. Or they're grieving over what they deserved and didn't get. Think the good stuff. Consistent praise, consistent support, somebody showing up at ball games or cheerleading competitions, or it doesn't matter what it is. But it's on the element of things that are praiseworthy, the praise was ignored, all that kind of stuff. It's grieving over what never was, which means the life circumstances, the facts and life circumstances of your early life. Grieving over what is not now, so it'd be facts and circumstances of what's happening for you now, and then grieving over what may never be. All of that comprises disguised grief.
It's powerful, because then when you know that that's the case, then you can go to the next step.
Right. So grief, again, it's part of my framework. The way I look at grief is that it's encompassed at least by the experiences of sadness, helplessness, anger, and disappointment. Just grief proper. Not disguised grief, just grief on its own. Disguised grief is just what I named, the two different kinds of categories of that. And the way then to work through it, it's outlined in the book. I talk about a kind of a grief reset protocol. And it's using the mnemonic, or the word grief, as the key to remember. So the G is grieving, and it's grieving over those five categories that I just named. The R is to identify a particular memory to work with. And then the I is to inquire more deeply. And the essence of people making their way through these experiences is to make sense of what they went through. And lots of times, I think we loop over, and then it feels like feelings linger for us when we don't resolve and make sense of what we've been through. So when I'm talking about making sense, I'm talking about particularly understanding the impact and the meaning that an experience had for somebody over time. The point at which it occurred, as you aged, and now. So it's allowing yourself to really reflect on what all that meant for you. Then once they've made sense of that impact and meaning, it's to extract the good. So it's like, what good came out of this for me? And so what did you learn, and how did you use it to your advantage? You know, for somebody, for instance, who grew up in a chaotic household, often stays in school longer and achieves more. So bad circumstance, difficult life experiences, but it led to a skill set that allowed you to advance in life. So there's good that came out of the bad. And there's, you know, there's most bad experiences, in quotes, most bad experiences, difficult life experiences, we can extract something positive that came out of it.
Spiritual teachers and other individuals say that that's the primary reason that we're here. If we didn't have that wound, we wouldn't be present to those circumstances and be able to put attention to it.
Right. The wound or the pain is the portal to our growth.
The portal. As you're sharing, it reminds me of the relationship, research-based relationship intervention for couples, the Gottman method.
Right.
And inside the Gottman method, they talk about how if there's repeated anger or these feelings that are showing up against your partner, the real question is, what is the underlining resentment that was maybe never resolved?
Right.
Are you really upset at this particular thing? Or did something happen when the two of you early on started dating or got married that just was never resolved internally with you?
Right.
That the other person may not even know.
Exactly.
Was a feeling or component that was there.
Right.
But now this repeated pattern of anger, unpleasant feelings that somebody's going through, they're just the branches, but at the root was the tree trunk of this one situation when you felt your partner wasn't there for you early on, and everything built on top of that.
Right, exactly.
So the disguised grief, and it's outlined deeply inside the book. I highly, highly recommend checking that out and noticing those components. And many people who do reflective work on their own will see that they, as they're uncovering their feelings and trying to figure out what's going on, they'll naturally do this. But I often find that frameworks are really important because it just makes it a lot easier to make it a habit as part of your life. It's not just happenstance. Oh, I went to this conference and I felt amazing. Well, what did you experience there? What did you dig into? What is the framework that you went through? And how can you ultimately start teaching yourself about those things?
Right. And from it, yeah. I mean, my goal is that people can use this as a guidebook for themselves. Yeah.
So through all your years of clinical practice, you found that speaking your truth is singularly the most important action you take to cultivate confidence, authenticity, and resilience. Tell us about speaking your truth and why is that?
Speaking up is so important because it actually helps us have a different experience of ourselves. It's the first line of defense with other people. It's like, no, stop, don't do that. So we have a sense of protection. Or, no, I can't join you to help you move your belongings at, you know, move your house, whatever. I don't have that time. As opposed to ignoring that I don't have that time and going and doing it and then being resentful because of it. It's our first way of saying, this is me. And kind of putting that stake in the ground. And I think what ends up happening, I have no way to prove it, or science maybe can, is that I think it changes our molecules. It changes how we experience ourselves. And it's entirely tied to, our ability to handle these 8 unpleasant feelings. The reason we don't speak up is because we don't want to handle the discomfort of our own emotional discomfort. Think 8 unpleasant feelings, nor handle the discomfort of your emotional discomfort simultaneously. Think the same 8 unpleasant feelings. So it's all about the discomfort of emotional discomfort that prevents us from speaking.
Our own, or the projection of, okay, if I speak up, this person might be angry.
Right.
They might be upset.
Right.
They might be this, they might be that.
Correct.
And do I have the capacity to
tolerate that? Right, exactly. But it's the same 8 unpleasant feelings.
Same 8.
No different. And what's interesting to me is that speaking up is not about getting the benefits that we want. So I might come to you and say, Drew, I'd really like a raise. Or I'd love to hang out with you. You know, you seem like a cool guy. And you go, not some, whatever. They go, no, I'm not going to do the raise. It's, I have to be able to handle the unpleasantness of whatever the response might be in order to engage you. But it's not even about getting that. To me, the getting what we want when we speak up is the benefit. It is not the goal. So when therapists tell people to go speak up, or anybody, when you're helping others solve problems, you say you've got to speak up in that situation. The reason you're telling that person to speak up is for their own growth.
Because normally what might happen is that somebody could hold on to the feeling of, I feel angry and unappreciated because my boss doesn't see me and they haven't given me the raise. And it's like, okay, well, when you speak up, one way or another, you're going to get some information.
Exactly.
Is this the job you should be staying at?
Right.
Is there something in your own performance that can be improved? Right. Or did they simply forget and now you're bringing it to the top of mind or some other variation?
Exactly.
The growth comes through the speaking up, and that's what you're looking for, because how you handle one thing is how you will handle other things.
Right. Right. So what I want people to understand is the purpose of speaking up is to grow you. The benefit of speaking up is getting what you want.
It's a huge distinction for a lot of people, because then it's like, I spoke up and they didn't give me what I wanted. I'm not going to do it again.
And no.
And that becomes a pattern for people.
No, the beauty of it is if you don't get it, it's another opportunity to grow by experiencing the same 8 unpleasant feelings. It just can increase your confidence, not the other way around.
Right.
And what I have found is speaking up is like the super glue to confidence. If you can't do it, you're never going to have that deep sense.
So speaking up also relates to another area, and it comes to this component of what other people think about me.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done a few podcasts on this in different ways and beliefs and that sort of thing. But often the information that people give themselves as to why they won't speak up,
right,
if you just listen and hear people's conversations or if you hear your internal dialogue, is that, what will people think of me?
Right.
When you hear that, when you hear somebody say that, what do people think about me, or I'm worried about what people think about me, so I'm not taking these risks and putting myself out there, what comes up for you?
Vulnerability. The way I see worry about, actually, I would make distinctions here too. It's not worry about what others are thinking about you. It's worry about what you think other people are thinking about you. There's even a nuanced distinction around mm-hmm. that. So, and the way I look at it is, if you are engaged in worrying about what you think other people are thinking, you're distracting yourself from feeling vulnerable. Come back to the experience of being vulnerable and drop the thinking part, because all the thinking part is a distraction. That's it.
So for somebody who is thinking about embarking on a different path in their career, you know, like yourself, maybe they're a clinician, maybe they're somebody who's, you know, extremely studious and they want to write about these topics that
right.
seem like self-development and this and that are not academic, and they're dealing with imposter syndrome,
uh-huh.
right? This feeling of like, well, what if I did that? What are the people going to think about me? What would you suggest to them?
Same thing. For me, it comes back down to the same 8 feelings. It's not, well, and the imposter syndrome is a little weave from this. But so the key for me is when you start to worry about worry about what you think other people think, you're distracting yourself from feeling vulnerable.
And when you get clear that you're feeling vulnerable, then what happens from there?
The essence, this is the beauty of the whole model for me, Drew. The key is understanding that when you feel vulnerable, if you know that you can experience and move through those other 7 feelings, you can handle the experience of vulnerability, this idea that I could be hurt. And it's knowing that you can handle those other 7 feelings that allows you to choose into vulnerability. So I'm going to go learn the skill. I'm going to go ask the person out for a date. I'm going to go ask the boss for a raise. I'm going to go learn the skill of dancing, right? It's because I'm willing to tolerate the other 7 repeatedly in order to get to my goal. So I can choose into vulnerability. So the worry about what other people think of you is just recast it as vulnerability. You can do the other 7, you're golden. You follow me on that?
I do. And in the sense of, so the feeling of vulnerability comes up, the recognition and the awareness that I can walk through the other seven, the wave is there. And then going back to, the one choice, eight feelings in 90 seconds, you're in that space. And is it a mental thing? Is it the breathing through it? You know, walk us through the actual components of when you're feeling those.
Yeah, no, it would be. Well, the first part of it is breathing through it. Slow your breathing down.
Yeah.
Because that will center and ground you. It's an immediate calming response. So that would be the first step. The second is, once you've done that and you can recognize what the feeling is, then ask yourself, be curious, ask yourself a couple questions. It's like, huh, to your point earlier, what was I thinking just before I felt this? What's going on for me right now? Huh, I wonder what this is attached to. So a couple quick questions can not only, the deep breathing can ground you, but those couple quick questions can also center you even further. And then that's all it takes. By that time, you're actually through the feeling. Mm. And now you've made meaning of it. And now you can use it to make a decision. You can use it for expressing yourself, or you can use it to take some kind of an action.
And it's usually through the feeling of it. And so many individuals have gone through this. I know I've gone through this. You have this big buildup because there's a suppression of a feeling, right? I'll give a perfect example. In my early career, I had an avoidance around, like a difficult email. I was in the client services business. I had started a company while I was in college, and I'm both going to school and also building this company. And I'd get an email and I would project upon it, just seeing the subject line, that this is gonna be something difficult, heavy, maybe they're upset, maybe they're this, they're that. And I would torment myself by not addressing it right away, feeling the feelings, projecting all the bad situations. What if they don't like me? What if I get fired? What if I get this, that, whatever it might be? And you open it up, and even if it was the client wasn't happy with something, it's like, okay, that wasn't that bad. This is what needs to be done. It's the awareness and addressing the actual specific situation and feeling it versus the suppression, which just keeps that unpleasant feeling going and going and going because it's not been addressed.
Right. There's actually a concept called thought suppression. And so it's I'm not going to think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm not going to think about that actually exacerbates the situation.
I often think about that when people say, I don't have time to deal with that.
Right.
I'm not going to deal with that right now. I don't have time to think about that. It's like, as if you can just turn your mind off,
which
that feeling is going to be there.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. There's all these phrases that we use to act like we're distancing ourselves from something unpleasant.
Correct.
But the fastest and most direct pathway forward is to actually embrace it.
Right.
On that side, going back to the question that I asked you about the book, I want to just touch on imposter syndrome. Can you describe it? Because not everybody's familiar with the term.
Right.
Describe it in the way that most people talk about it. And how do you think about it? And how is it related to these one choice, eight feelings, 90 seconds, and what we process?
Well, the most people will talk about imposter syndrome as that they're engaged. It's usually often used when people are engaged in a work setting. So we hear it more often there than in life. Because most people don't walk in life and go, I feel like an imposter. It's relative to what their career is.
And usually a leap that somebody might want to take.
Right. Or they've started in a field. Yeah. So, I mean, I can remember when I first started, I probably had that sensation. It's like, am I a fraud here?
Yeah.
Do I really have the skills to do what I'm doing? So underneath the question is, do I really have what it takes? Do I really have the skills to do what I'm doing? But many people will use it when they're actually highly skilled and highly competent in an area, and they'll still call themselves an imposter. And I think that comes about for two main reasons. One is someone's not speaking the truth about themselves. So nobody really knows them. It's too much privacy, too much guardedness. And so when you come up to me, if I'm the one that's doing it, and you come up to me and you say, hey, wow, great job, or that was really cool, or what something on that order, in my head, the next response is, yeah, but if you only knew the real me.
Right.
Right? How many people say that?
How many times do people belittle compliments that they get from other individuals?
Right, right. So the first part of that is if they're saying, if you only knew the real me, it's because they're not speaking up enough. The second part of it is they dismiss compliments. And for me, compliments are super important. And I have a nice long section in the book about this, but the essence of it is that a compliment is a reflection of you back to you. It's like a mirror. So it's not, I'm not pulling it out of the blue, out of a vacuum someplace and going, oh, here, Drew, have a compliment. It's because I've had an engaged experience with you or of you that I go, hey, that was a great conversation. Loved it. Or loved hanging out with you.
And when you reject it or you belittle it, it's almost like you don't internalize the receiving of it.
Right. You never allow yourself to absorb it. And for me, compliments, it's like varnish over stain. It seals goodness in. Mm. Or for women, it's the top coat on the nails, right? It seals something in. It seals goodness in.
So for anybody that's listening that sees that they do this,
dismiss
they have this
compliments,
pattern,
right?
Dismiss compliments. How can they use awareness and sort of the themes that you talk about to break that pattern?
Well, there's one other piece to it that I want people to understand, and then let me respond to that. When we take in compliments, genuine compliments, it allows us to update our self-image. So if we do two things, we express ourselves more if we've been guarded, and we start to absorb and take in, really take in the compliments we're given. Both of those help us update our experience ourselves and update our self-image, which then allows us to feel more confident and go out in the world in a whole different way.
This goes back to the thing that you were talking about, which is that you have to put yourself out there to actually get the confidence in the first place.
Right.
So in your first, you talked about two things, you talked about expressing yourself more. So if there's an idea, a theme, something you want to do more of, the first question is, are you organizing your life and creating the circumstances so that you can express that, so that you can put out there that talent, that skill set, that vision, that trait that you have that you want to give more of? Are you actually in the doing? It reminds me of our friend Marie Forleo, who writes a lot about business and
right.
and helping women build businesses. So you find your purpose in doing.
Correct.
You're not going to sit in a room just by yourself
right.
and just all of a sudden come up with your purpose. It's through the doing and it's through the action that you get clearer and clearer about what your purpose is and how it can unfold.
Yes, definitely agree. Definitely agree. Yeah. I'm going to try to come back. You had another question in terms of the...
Yes, how do we use awareness?
About the compliments.
Yes, yes. Okay, yes. So to go back to that question that I was asking you, how would... For anybody that recognizes that they dismiss compliments...
Right.
How can they break that pattern so that they can update their self-image?
The easiest and fastest is simply to say thank you. Really.
It's done.
That's the starting point. And so even if you go, well, thanks. So don't do no dismissing responses in response to a compliment, because there's temptations to go, oh, it was nothing. I was just lucky. Oh, I maybe have a little bit of skill. No. None of those responses. They don't come out of your mouth. They just stay in your head. So the first response is simply, thank you, even if it feels awkward to say that. Then go home or go someplace and give yourself an opportunity to reflect and take it in. It's like, all right, my first thing was to say no. I said yes. All right, what did that compliment really feel like or mean to me?
Mm.
So I don't want people to just then walk away from it and go, fine. I actually want them to engage in some self-reflection and start to absorb it. There's an exercise at the end of that section about compliments where I actually have people kind of go through an exercise where they stack compliments in their hand. And then ultimately bring them to their heart.
Mm.
So I really want people to absorb them.
And for anybody that's also wanting to improve their friendships, relationships, partnership, what is important for them to know about compliments and giving compliments?
Same thing. If you feel this was a lesson learned early in life for me. Goes back to my camp counseling days. Children would often hang on me as a camp counselor. And what I began to understand, I was 18 years old, 18, 19, but the experience of the kind of innocent, just attaching, it's like, I want to hang around you, right? We have so much fun when we're around you, kind of a reaction. Taught me an immense amount about love and compliments. It's like, if I love this, this feels so good to me. Just this unmitigated, playful, engaged exchange in life. It's like, what would it mean if I did that for other people? If I love this, other people are going to love this. So what you want more of, you give more of. So you give more love if you want more love. You give more compliments if you want more compliments.
And when you notice that somebody might not be taking in your compliment.
Right.
Do you ever in that moment, if it feels right, to say, hey, like just sit with that for a second.
Yes. Yeah.
Like I'm, you know.
Yeah.
Don't dismiss that.
Yeah.
That is something really special you just did.
Right. Right. Because it actually dismisses the compliment giver.
Yeah.
And their reality. When you dismiss the compliment.
Mm.
So you're not only dismissing your own reality, you're dismissing the reality of the person who's giving the compliment. So my thing is, yes, please, if you experience it, what a gift to give other people is to compliment them.
I want to end on the topic of resilience.
Mm.
It's a big word in the last few years, and we talk about it in so many different capacities. What does resilience mean to you, and how do you think about it in the framework of what you teach in your book?
I start thinking about resilience as first the foundation of those 8 unpleasant feelings.
And our ability to work
to move, experience
them,
and move through them. Yeah, right. So the one element of resilience is to be able to experience and move through 8 unpleasant feelings. Second element has to do with your capacity to speak up and express. So that's going to make a huge difference in your ability to bounce back. And resilience is this whole idea of bouncing back. But my thing is, I want people to bounce back further than where they first started. So those are the first two, to be able to experience and express the full range of what we feel. The others have to do with sometimes taking action makes a difference. So if I serve others, And I go for helping people in a way that, it's like, let's say I feel kind of down and out, but I go help somebody else. That kind of taking action in the service of someone else can help us be more resilient. But the broadest brushstroke for me around developing resilience, we can learn it, and we can learn to be much more resilient, is to think about the attitudes that we hold. Because I think so much of resilience is, if you will, attitudinal or belief-driven. So, for instance, do I have the capacity to handle change? A lot of people don't like change. And my thing is, I want people to be flexible and adaptive in the face of change. And that's more of where, when I'm working with a client, that's more of where my focus goes. It's like, I know routine is important. Stability is important, but I want you to have the capacity to handle change.
In the sense of like a growth mindset versus fixed, somebody who leans into change versus the first sight of even thinking that something's about to change, they lean back.
Right, right. So that would be one. Another, in terms of an attitude, that I'm open to change and I'm willing to be flexible and adaptive in the face of change. A second would be every life experience for me is a learning experience. So that doesn't matter whether I would identify it as bad or good, I'm going to turn this into something I can learn from.
That's a big one. So many people feel like they look at life as bad or good, and it's like it's all learning, it's all growth.
Right. The capacity to ask other people for help it helps people be more resilient, which I also see as a part of emotional strength. So that's crucial. I do a checklist at the end of the book. There's probably about 20 or 25 different attitudes and actions you can take. Faith is another one. So people just turning to their own experience of faith. So it's really it, but think attitude in addition to those other basics I named as what's going to help someone be much more resilient in life.
Mm. What a beautiful and great and deep conversation. I think there's not one thing that's been mentioned here that people can't relate to in some capacity of their life. And I love how you gave us the framework and you kept on taking us deeper, but it comes back to the source of working through and moving through these 8 original feelings. Dr. Rosenberg, thank you for being on our podcast. For our listeners who want to learn more about you and find your book, 90 Seconds to a Life You Love, where can they go to dig in?
Well, my website, drjoanrosenberg.com. The book is everywhere you get books. So it's on Amazon if you go to use Amazon as your source, or it's also in traditional bookstores. And it's in different places around the world as well. So,
and you're active on social media.
I'm active on social media. So Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Yes.
And there's a bonus gift that you have for the listeners.
With drjoanrosenberg.com/gift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For anybody who's hearing these, can resonate to them. Maybe a lot of unpleasant feelings are coming up in this conversation of even just how much I often recognize, like, when people get clear, just how mean they are to themselves sometimes, just how, for not being able to handle situations better, how, you know, the world would be such a better place with forgiveness towards ourselves when it comes to things. Or anybody that can listen to your story and being told that when they were younger, they were boring or they were too much this or that. Any words for those individuals?
Well, you're going to take me down the path of one more thing,
please,
if you don't
please.
Mind.
No, that's why we're here.
Okay. All right. And it's the whole notion of harsh self-criticism.
Yeah.
And because I think it's one of the most destructive things we can do to ourselves. I really want people to put an end to it. And many might go, what are you talking about? I can't stop that stuff. And my response is, yes, you can. First off. The second is, think of harsh self-criticism or all that negative self-talk as a thought hijack of unpleasant feelings. The same 8 unpleasant feelings.
So that one of those 8 feelings takes root, hijacks your thoughts completely, and now you're stuck in that paradigm.
No, it's I felt something I didn't want to feel. And we don't have control over that we feel or what we feel. We do have control over how and what we think. So it's a little bit more complicated. Again, this is such a central part of my whole thinking around what changes us and how we can live better and fuller and more alive lives. But when we engage in harsh self-criticism, we're actually trying to move away from that unpleasant feeling and taking charge of it by beating up on ourselves.
Mm.
Allegedly creating the equivalent feeling, except it's not. It's far worse.
Mm.
And we do such damage to ourselves. So when I first start working with somebody, if they're engaged in that, one of the first things that has to go is how they treat themselves. That has to change, because I can't get to all the good stuff if you're only willing to engage in the destructive stuff. So I really want people to kind of grab hold of this one, because it's super important to really put a stop to it and to understand your thought hijacking your own unpleasant emotional experience every time you engage in harsh self-criticism. Just go back to the eight feelings, reverse course. The question you asked earlier, what was I thinking just before I did this?
To do the work on
right, right,
and breathe through it.
Right, and to kind of an ending comment. I'd probably say two things. One is I want people to be able to experience and express the whole range of what they feel. And then the second is to remember that if you can experience and move through one or more 90-second bodily sensation waves of one or more of eight unpleasant feelings, you can go pursue anything you want in life.
That's beautiful and so well said. Dr. Rosenberg, thank you for joining us and sharing your wisdom on the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you, Drew. It's been awesome.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.